Take a network break. Update your virtual donut patches to mitigate that mustard filling that accidentally slipped in production. And join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. I'm Drew Conrad-Murray. Greg Farrow is here. Today's show is being sponsored in part by Interoptic. Interoptic offers high performance, high quality optics at a fraction of the cost. And you can find out more at interoptic.com. We're also sponsored today by Cisco. You can learn how Cisco and its trusted partners, Equilibrium Security and E+ IGX, can help your organization tackle the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR. Tune into Packet Pusher's Priority Queue episode 147 to get practical insights on how to get your arms around those wide-ranging rules. And stay tuned after the news for a sponsored coffee talk conversation with VMware. We're going to talk about the company's SD-WAN strategy with Sanjay Uppal. He is VP of VMware's VeloCloud business unit. We're going to talk about how VeloCloud SD-WAN is being integrated with NSX.
Oh, I love me some SD-WAN, you know.
You do love SD-WAN, yes.
It's the horse's, guts for garters, horse's du jour, or whatever it is.
The bee's knees, as we say.
The bee's knees, the duck's guts, as they say. And what VeloCloud doing, really exciting. I mean, while we still wait to see what Cisco and Viptel is doing, we haven't seen their strategy sort of leap out yet, but VeloCloud's got some interesting stuff happening. And now that they're integrating with NSX, they're really saying that the WAN and the data center is one thing. It's really surprising, so it's worth tuning into that.
Yeah, check it out. VMware has some ambitious networking plans. It's going to be interesting to see how this goes down. Speaking of interesting networking plans, Arista, they're leading off our news this week. They're going after Cisco in the campus. They've got two new core aggregation switches that are designed to go after Cisco's deeply entrenched Catalyst family.
Proving once and for always that a switch is a switch is a switch.
So you're saying whether the switch is for a data center or a campus, it's just a switch?
Yes, I think so. I do believe that for a few years there, there was a need for different switches for the data center because they tended to be for high density and slightly higher speeds. But what we've seen, of course, is the technology sort of surpass what
enterprises essentially need.
That's right. Yeah. You know, most enterprises are still using 1 gig in the data center. All right. Well, do you really need redundant power supplies, redundant super? You don't really need a chassis going forward because we're now seeing 48 port 10 gig switches come down under the sort of $10,000 to $15,000 mark. And that's what we used to use chassis for, was to get that sort of numbers. And then, you know, as servers grew and now they have so much power and their blades, and really, you know, a two or a four switch design is all you need. It's going to be interesting to see how it works out. But basically what Arista's doing is taking its existing switching technology and saying, ready for campus, big stamp.
That's right.
That's really it, you know.
It is kind of it. Yeah. I mean, I guess they're saying that the value proposition they're trying to put forward is if you're already using Arista in the data center and you like our operational model, you like our software, you like the telemetry we can provide you, you like the visibility we can get you with EOS, why not bring that to your campus core?
Yeah, well, I've got some concerns. I mean, it's fairly obvious as a move. You want to grow your total addressable market. You also probably got customers champing at the bit saying, look, I've got all these switches in my campus that, you know, they said that the average age of Catalyst 6500s in the enterprise, which are being used in the campus, are 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all 2 years out from starting to think about throwing those away. 10 years is like a magic number for networking in enterprise. So they're all sort of starting to lay down their strategy. So we saw Cisco sort of rush SD Access out at Cisco Live last year, and it had all of the aspects of it that sort of said, not ready, not finished, not, you know, shouldn't buy it sort of thing. But it's a strategy to say, don't go anywhere else. You know, just hold tight. We got something.
We got big plans for the campus. Just hold tight, and we promise you all kinds of goodies. And Arista's saying,
that's right. Yep.
Don't focus so much on the goodies. Focus on some essential capabilities, and we can bring that to you.
So I think the concern here is that there are two switches based on the Trident 3 silicon, is what they're promoting as being the start of their campus solutions. Now, every time I've talked to companies using white box switching about the Trident 3 in the campus, they've just said the price point doesn't fit. So Arista's saying, well, we're going to use it as campus spines. So we're going for the big, heavy, hot core switches, which aggregate a lot of high-speed ports. Okay, fine. And then they told us they're partnering with Aruba for the edge.
That's right. They're going to use Aruba for wireless and also the access switches, yeah.
Yeah, which makes sense because in the campus, you have to have a unified strategy. You can't just say,
right,
I've got a core switch, go and buy somebody else's and put them on the edge. You know, go and buy some.
Right, that doesn't sell very well.
Not a popular strategy. People do really want to get a one if they're going for a, you know, multi-million dollar refresh of the campus, which is what people seem to do. But increasingly, I mean, the campus isn't that complicated. So I think the first thing I have is, you know, Trident 3 based silicon hasn't typically been priced in competitively for these sorts of solutions. People in the campus don't want a lot of features. They don't need very large TCAMs. They don't need routing protocols, you know, all these extra features that the data center has been promised. So I think that Arista is basically taking the easy way in here, got a switch, it's the campus switch now, and we don't have to do any significant R&D. They're going to use the same EOS software, so there's no change or delta there. So I'm concerned about, you know, are the Trident 3 chipsets cheap enough? But it makes me then suspect that Arista must be out looking for a lower cost ASIC. So there's half a dozen or a dozen companies out there who have low cost ASICs in the space that do like 48 by 1 gig E. And they could go to an OEM and say, make us a switch with this ASIC. And I don't think that's Broadcom. I don't think Broadcom has campus ASICs, but maybe they do. And whether they support the same SDK that EOS needs for the data center, that's another question that I'm not sure of the answer of. So I suspect Arista's been out there for a while, shopping around where it's going to go with the campus. For now, they're partnering with Aruba. We know they're already partnered with HPE for selling data center switches. Sometimes HPE will sell Comware or, you know, because that's the, they want an all HPE solution. And sometimes they'll sell Arista. I suspect that in the US, companies will want a US-based switch. They wouldn't want to see the largely Chinese-based Comware in their data center. There's a political, you know, and a perceived area there which are of concern. We'll talk more about that later in the show.
Yes.
But I do think that Arista is going to start small. But I also think that Cisco's SD Access leaves a big hole in the market, don't you?
I have a slightly different take on this. I feel like, well, for one, we talked last week about how Arista had a pretty good quarter and still got a little bit of spanking from the market because there's this perception that the growth they've had with cloud scale buyers may be slowing down. And so Arista is looking to, as you said, expand its addressable market. So there's that. But if you're talking about the campus, the real action is around that access layer, that sort of the wireless or where people are attaching to the network. Particularly if we're talking about IoT, there's a lot of effort around making that onboarding of devices easier, more secure. Right now, Arista has no story there. So,
They've got a fancy name for it, cognitive cloud networking, instead of just calling it intent-based.
Right.
Arista with their naming strategy is always a bit entertaining. They've got to give everything a name, a fancy name.
They do.
That only they have. And then they go and patent, copyright it.
Right. The other thing is that they're partnering with Aruba, which is fine. But Aruba also last year rolled out its own great big brand new honking core aggregation switch. So that relationship has to be a little bit touchy, I think.
Yeah, and they've got ClearPass, which is the security technology that manages access at the edge. That's Aruba's product.
That's Aruba's, yes.
Is Arista going to go head-to-head with that?
Right.
But I think there's also a market in here, which is what Arista grew into, which is Cisco wanted to go up to ACI and sort of went out there, and they're doing the same thing with SD Access. They're saying to the customers, your old campus is no good. You have to have an SDN one. And so now what we're going to do is throw out all your switches, throw out everything that you knew and you've been using for the last 20 years, and you're going to do SD Access or ACI. And no questions asked, you don't get to choose. You have to have it. You can't.
That's right.
Right? Whereas if you're somebody who says, well, I don't need that, I'm going to do it some other way. So maybe you're moving to all wireless. So you just want to use a very simple ClearPass is really your solution. Or, you know, if you're using NSX, you don't need ACI, right? You could use ACI, but generally it doesn't make sense to have both. The cost is just not money well spent. So if you don't want it, well, what do you do? So I think Arista sort of grew in the data center in behind the fact that there was a lot of companies who didn't want SDN and didn't want to go down the path that Cisco won. They left a gap there for Arista to slide into.
Right.
And then they've steadily been building up into the, you know, they've got their SDN controller, the cloud vision stuff that they've been, the EOS vision. Yeah.
Right. I think Arista is nicely positioned here in that they see an opportunity as Cisco's starting to push customers to upgrade with SD Access. If you're already in that upgrade cycle, why not take a look at Arista at the same time?
That's right. And then Arista's going to come in and say, no, don't go and do all that software stuff. Just buy some switches and keep it what it is, but just get us, you know, we've got our EOS and this is our great story. It's tested, it works, it's reliable, it doesn't have the bugs that Cisco's got. Pricing slightly cheaper. You know we're good for it because we've been doing it in the data center. And they move into that slot that Cisco's vacating. And effectively, Cisco's going up market. They're upselling companies into SD Access. They're upscaling the pricing. They're adding security. They're adding monitoring. They're adding remote cloud-based support and cloud-based in. Like, it's an enormous organizational transition.
That's
and
right.
If you don't want to, then that leaves a place for Arista to just get in there and then move up as the customer matures over time, right?
Right. Yeah, so Cisco's whole strategy with SD Access, the idea is they're adding value, they're adding new features, but they are also bringing more complexity to the campus. Arista's saying, let's keep it simple.
I think that's where they're going to start. So that's their way in.
Yeah.
And then over time, as they build up their portfolio, invest, develop a campus strategy, find out what marketing messaging, like these companies don't burst onto the scene with working sales methodologies and tools and wording. And the way that we see these big companies work is they actually don't know what customers want. They don't know what they're doing. They've got some ideas about how they might go ahead with getting it to market. So they're going to go out there now and start knocking on doors and saying, we do campus switches now. What is it you want? And the customers go, I don't know. What are you selling me? And Arista's going to go, well, we've got this stuff. And they go, look, that doesn't look like what we want. And they go back to the head office and say, you haven't got what we want. We need to make the thing that they want. And the product manager is going to say, well, what do they want? And they said, well, the customer doesn't know what they want. They asked us what to get and sell us. You know? So that, see, that's 3 years right there.
Okay. So Arista's got some work to do.
Yeah. But, you know, Cisco with SDAccess has done the same thing. Let's not, you know, and to some extent, Aruba, you know, started with wireless and moved into the campus Ethernet.
Right. And moving into the core. Yeah.
That's right. And now they're moving into the core. They're just all doing the same thing. And eventually they'll all, you know, and of course, Brocade has still got its stuff. Extreme's over there got a very strong story with the campus. Really, up until now, campus has been Extreme versus Cisco. Of course, Extreme being Brocade, Avaya, and its own Extreme switches. Now they're converging. Mm-hmm. But that was the four campus line, you know, aside right. from HP, Comware, the ProCurves, you know, really that was it. So interesting times. You know, the campus networking has been stable forever. It's been done. Didn't have to do anything, know how it works. It's all spanning tree. It's all rubbish. It works pretty badly, but we know how to make it work one way or the other. Now we're going to see whether Cisco can bring people, drag people up to the higher value, higher profit margin, recurring revenue that they need to meet their goals. And the question is, how many customers are they going to abandon over the time? How many customers are going to walk away from where Cisco wants them to go and look at other choices? So there's an opportunity there.
Right, and Arista sees enough opportunity that they can make a little money picking up those customers.
But I wouldn't be racing out to buy it today. This is a make some noise. We're going to do some campus. We're going to get out there and see what customers want, and then we're going to start iterating towards that. You know, do we need to sell them a 48 by 1 gig port switch, or can we partner with somebody else? We don't want to make more switches. You know, we don't have to hold stock and find hundreds of millions of dollars worth of manufacturing runs. Could we partner with the – we'll give that a go, see if that works. So, you know, don't race into this. Give it time. Let the people, the lemmings run over the edge, if you like, and move on from there.
All right. All right. This is definitely a story we'll be coming back to, but we got to move on. Talking about now Qualcomm, Bloomberg reporting that Qualcomm is planning to walk away from efforts to develop ARM-based chips that were supposed to compete with Intel in the data center.
Yeah, well, this ARM in the server has been around for a very, very long period of time, probably 6 to 8 years, rumors, and then working products. HPE came out with an ARM-based server, and the big deal here is that Qualcomm has been the biggest backer of ARM CPUs, like taking designs from ARM and manufacturing them into server-grade CPUs. And if they're giving up, that's probably a sign that the whole game's over.
You think so?
I'd say so. I think Intel's recent, you know, sort of failures, and it pushed off into different markets and pulled back, and now it's not getting to 10 nanometers. So I think Intel's going to say, well, we have to reduce our prices, or we have to, you know, their movements into NVMe and a range of new technologies in the data center kind of freezes ARM out in a way. And the CPU vulnerabilities won't help either.
That's tough for Intel, yeah, those vulnerabilities.
Yeah. So, you know, if Intel suddenly realizes that its core product is under threat, it might circle the wagons and chase everybody out. Because I think Intel's been distracted doing a range of other things more recently, you know, chasing the IoT and the goggles and the drones, and then trying to get their chips into modems, and then and sort of the x86 stuff, sort of, you know, the 10 nanometer CPUs they announced in 2016 and supposed to come in 2017 now won't come to 2019, probably later. So maybe they're rounding up the horses and getting stuck in, and Qualcomm sees it's time to get out.
I think that's actually the sort of the between the lines reading I get from the Bloomberg story about Qualcomm was that they were getting outside pressure from investors saying, stick to your knitting, stick to what you're good at. You're wasting money. We want you to be more profitable doing what you do best. Let's just walk away from this.
Yeah. It's also getting Linux. Like, you've got to remember that Intel spends over $1 billion a year in the Linux kernel with developers and access and resources and marketing. And, you know, they put a lot of support into making sure that Linux runs on the x86. Now, who's going to do that for ARM?
Right. All right, moving on. A survey taken of attendees at the recent RSA conference found that 26% of respondents have ignored critical vulnerabilities because they didn't have time to patch them.
Now, anybody who works for an enterprise company will not be surprised at this point. In fact, the only thing you'd be surprised about is how low that number is.
Exactly. Right. It should be more like 99%.
I would have thought 70, 60 to 70%.
Yeah.
would be the thing. You know, the boss says, well, we have to do these new projects first. Patches can come later, and put a firewall in front of it that mitigates the rule, or just cross fingers and pretend it's not a problem.
La, 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 la. My fingers are in my ears.
So why is that number low? I think it's because if you do a poll of people at RSA Security and ask them if they're incompetent at security about security, they're not going to admit to that.
Right. Well, 74% of them aren't going to admit to it.
Clearly. Some part of that 74%. And so, of course, the issue here is this is why you have pen testing, penetration testing being done, and you book it, because it finds these bugs and forces the attention of the executives onto these issues. So, yes, I think that's a laughable 26%, my bum.
All right, well, here's some numbers that you might find more believable. This is another story from another survey, a different survey. It's coming from Dark Reading. This survey reported 77.2% of respondents said their organization was breached at least once in 2017. And more than a quarter of respondents said they were breached at least six times in a single year.
All right, so this turns around from the other side.
This is the naked honesty. Yep, they got us.
Yeah, I don't know if this is naked honesty. This sounds like I found a magic number in a survey and I'm going to blow it up. You know what I mean? I'm going to pour gasoline on this. This is, I think, you know, define breach. Are you talking about a piece of malware got into your email system but nobody was impacted? Is that what you're talking about?
I guess I didn't look at it that closely to see how they were defining breach.
So here's the question. Yeah. How many times do you estimate that your organization's global network has been compromised by a successful cyber attack in the past 12 months? Okay, so global network, define that. Compromised, define that. Cyber attack. Is that malware, or is that actually an active threat, or was it a passive threat? So was it somebody just scanning?
Yeah, did a virus hit one of your PCs and you cleaned it up before anything happened? Or did you get hit by a DDoS that, you know, lasted for 10 minutes and then went away? I guess all those could compromise. Yeah,
it's not a good question. That's, you know, you're asking in three parts. There's three questions in there. You know, I think it's a fairly open question. So I'm going to take this one with a dose of salt. And the answer to that one is, at some level, every company should be getting hit at any point in time. So the answer to this should be 100%. You've got viruses coming through. You've got attacks happening. You know, something's going to get through. But it's the real story here should be how many business impacting breaches happened in the last 12 months.
Right. Yes. What was the impact? How long did it take you to fix it?
Yes.
All right. Quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Interoptic. Demand from the edge, 5G and IoT are coming. If you're not doing your optics correctly, you might pay for it later. Interoptic understands you're going to need a more nimble layer zero, and that's why they support a full range of products that you need today and don't yet know that you're going to need tomorrow. So stop paying OEM prices for optics and start talking to optic experts who deliver brand equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the price. The difference between generic third party and brand equivalent optics matters. You can purchase the same, if not better, performing optics at a fraction of the cost. These optics are designed by engineers who truly understand what you need. So take control of your Interoptics purchase. Head on over to interoptic.com. You can learn how they can help you spec the right optics for your network. That's interoptic.com. Back to the news. You titled this one, Cloud Companies Don't Get Everything They Want. Apple apparently is walking away from a proposed $1 billion data center in Ireland. They wanted to build it there, but there were some local delays and protests, and so Apple's just throwing in the towel.
Yeah, this is just because there's a couple of things here. One is, you know, you'd think that Apple would have a golden spoon shoved down so far down its throat by the Irish government that they should have popped out the other end. You know, this is $1 billion.
Yes. Right?
And the point, this is actually going to be built in a town called Athenry. This is a part of Ireland where people don't really even live. This is like rural Ireland. And it's quite an impoverished area in some way. So this should be something that everybody should just be falling over themselves.
This should be municipally like a slam dunk. Yeah. Oh, a giant business wants to come in and build something and maybe create a few jobs and pump some money into the local economy. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Like even if it's create 10 jobs, that's quite right. A big number for that part of the town, right?
Right.
It seems a bit. So when you sort of start reading, I had to read a whole bunch of articles until you form a picture. It seems that there was just a couple of people in the area who were able to sort of abuse the legal process and to extend the planning process from 2015 until now. So every time the planning process comes in, they lodge objections, and then they object again. Then they engage lawyers. They took it to the High Court, and then the High Court said, no, this is approved. It's ready to go. So now they've said, well, we're going to take it to the Supreme Court. And so Apple's gone, right, we're done, pull out. And it wasn't until I read an article in the, I think it was Data Center Dynamics. It turns out that there's two local residents in the town who just continuously kept coming back. And then I read another article where it says McDonough had failed to elucidate the grounds for his appeal to a satisfactory level, and he has been trying to build a data center in Wicklow, the town on the other side of Ireland. He has also previously tried to sell the land to Apple, right? So I've got this picture. This is complete scuttlebutt. That there's somebody who thinks he's a big wheel in a rural town, and Apple comes to town and says, we're going to do this. And he goes, well, you have to do business with me. And when they didn't, he's just been making their life hell ever since. I'll bet you that's what it is. Pretty sure.
Or maybe he's got some people in the town who don't like him, and so they decide to make his life hell.
Yeah.
That's, boy, that's pretty impressive that just a few folks could scuttle what must have been essentially a done deal between the Irish government and Apple.
Yeah, yeah. It's just one of those things. You know, this is one of those things we process up. And they said the government had even introduced special laws so that any future projects like this would get special, you know, wouldn't even be possible to be, you know, scuttled at this. Like, it just sounds to me like it's a bit of local politics, and there's somebody there who's got some money who's decided to just take this on. You know, Apple didn't do, I'm going to take you down. You didn't do it with me, so I'm going to get even, sort of thing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, well, we've got another story about a company potentially being taken down. Chinese telecommunications company ZTE has halted major business operations due to a U.S. ban that forbids American companies from providing ZTE with parts and software. We talked a little bit about this last week. Now Reuters is reporting that ZTE has actually had to stop major operations while it tries to work this out.
So this is obviously related to the political climate in the U.S. I think that this is a bit unexpected. I don't think we expected ZTE. We can argue over that another day, to just close up shop, pull up and walk away. Typically, we've seen these companies take a long view. They slow down and then wait for the political climate to change. But here they're just packing up and going home, which is sort of a sign of where the political environment and how much impact the political environment is having on business climates. And I think the risk here is not obvious. I think this leaves the U.S. market open to U.S. companies who can get very high profits and high revenues from the U.S. market. But when they come out of the U.S. market, they're actually going to be sort of have, because they have such an easy life in the US, they're the only competitors, they're only selling at high prices with high profit margins into the US market because there's no real competition except amongst each other. When they get to Europe or Africa or Pacific Rim or to China, they're going to really struggle because now they're going to have to be like making half the money that they used to make outside of the US, if that makes sense.
So their competitive chops might get a little flabby, and the margins or income they can expect outside of the US is going to be significantly different because of there'll be more competition outside.
That's right. And the US market isn't a growing market compared to Pacific Rim, China, Africa.
Right.
And Europe, of course, is where the money is. So the European market is a substantial dollar value or revenue and a substantial profit margin. But the growth markets are in where ZTE will now be working. So I think the US companies, it could be a risk to these businesses that they get fat, lazy, and happy, you know, making hay without too much effort because they've got a protected market. And whether they'll be able to stay competitive globally might lead to a disruption in the longer term. That's why you have global competition. That's why we took the trade barriers down. We want the companies to be able to be competitive and to be global, not just stuck in one country or another. As you know, it's sort of like a rural advantage, if you will.
Right. Another outcome that I'm reading about is that people are saying this is going to further spur China to develop its own native businesses so it doesn't have to rely on Intel or Qualcomm for parts to drive products from companies like ZTE, which is essentially the issue here. If ZTE can't buy, you know, chips from Intel or Qualcomm or software like Android, then they've got to go do it themselves. And that's going to, you know, essentially become even more of a competitive issue for the United States going forward if China develops a really strong home market.
And that's going to be the natural reaction. If you can't buy these chips, give them, you know, it takes a few years, 2, 3, 5, whatever it is, and they'll be able to make their own optical components from, you know, innovation. They have, the government over there has shown no endless willingness to create universities and research institutions and say, okay, we can't buy them from Ciena or Infinera right now. Here's money from the Chinese government to go and invent this technology. Boom. Here's a university, you know, just dedicated to optical components.
We will build a city just for optical components.
Something like that. We don't know the real deal, but it's something familiar with that, yes.
Yeah. It's also pretty stunning to see the cat and mouse going on here with U.S. trade relations and China trade relations. It seems like this is very much a bold bet on the U.S.'s part to get some leverage over China to say, we've taken one of your sort of darling tech companies and ground it to a halt. We can reverse this. What are you going to give us back?
Yeah, I'm not sure. ZTE would, of course, like to have been in the US market. There's lots of revenue. There's lots of profits to be made there. It's a big market for them to participate in. They haven't been able to get in through the door until now. So they're not losing much by walking away because they haven't been able to.
It's not even just not having access to the US market. It's not being able to build their products because they can't buy the components they need. That's the real thing.
Well, they can't buy the intellectual property. A lot of the components are actually made in China. They're just the IP belongs in the US.
Right.
Or the science to research and develop the next generation. So it's just an interesting game to see this play out. I'm not sure. I think ZTE would have been happier to be able to compete and participate in the market, and it would get growth in the US market steadily over time. But the flip side of this is they're now going to throw their efforts into dominating Europe, Africa, China, Asia.
Right.
And in the long term, that's probably going to be more damaging to US companies than most people think.
Right. And yeah, instead of this short-term sort of quote-unquote victory for
yes,
US trade. Ugh.
That would be my concern anyway. Yeah. If I took a big picture journalist
if some inspirational cynicism analysis, yes. All right, moving on. Google, they are acquiring a cloud migration startup called VeloStrata. It's an Israeli startup. They use techniques they call real-time agentless workload streaming to help you move workloads from on-premises into cloud services.
So this is the idea that the enterprises need help to move onto the cloud, and therefore you need a service that can migrate your existing stuff into the cloud. We've seen AWS get big into this. We've seen HPE buy companies, Cisco buy companies in this space as well. And now, of course, it's
Google.
Well, Google. So it seems like it's going to be confusing for customers. I think you either go and talk to Google and VeloStrata will get you onto Google. So if you're all in with Google, then that's a good service. But if you want to use multi-cloud like AWS, Google, Azure, then you're going to need to talk to an integrator like Cisco, HPE, Dell, and they're going to have multi-cloud onboarding tools that are layered to work on multiple clouds.
Yeah, I think VeloStrata came to market as a multi-cloud service. They would help you get on AWS or Azure and then eventually Google, depending on what you wanted. And Google, by taking them off the board, sort of, one, they make potential, obviously the idea is that they'll make it easier for customers to get onto Google, which is great for them. But two, they also, sort of remove an avenue for customers to get onto AWS and Azure by buying up this company. Not that VeloStrata was the only one, but
No, I think it's just like this is a gap in their portfolio. Some companies are saying, how do we get onto your cloud? That Google's building an enterprise sales unit to try and reach enterprises to draw them onto the Google cloud.
Yeah,
and so now they can point at
VeloStrata and say, here, this is how you do it.
This is how you do it. We've got a thing for that. We've got a spanner that will get you into the cloud.
All right, a quick break to tell you about our other sponsor, Cisco. We're talking about the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, codifies data privacy and protection obligations for companies that handle data of EU citizens. That includes things like loss prevention, breach notification requirements, and there are fines and penalties if you violate these rules. So on Priority Queue episode 147, which is sponsored by Cisco, the Packet Pushers examine these requirements with Equilibrium Security and E+ IGX. These are two Cisco partners who share practical insights and advice for dealing with GDPR, including how to break down and understand the requirements, the importance of risk assessment and a gap analysis, and then how to use your existing security and management tools to actually comply with these regulations. You also get to hear a real-world customer case study that walks through the challenges and solutions. So head on over to packetpushers.net, search for Priority Queue 147, and you can get up to speed on GDPR. And we thank Cisco for being a sponsor.
Yeah, it was a good show because we're talking directly to resellers who are doing this down on the ground. So these are European resellers, and they wanted to talk about their experiences of getting GDPR ready for their clients.
Yes, check it out. It's Priority Queue 147. Okay, back to the news. British Telecom, or BT, is reportedly going to lay off 13,000 employees in a downsizing move, and the company is also going to move to a smaller headquarters in London.
Yeah, so BT has been in some prime real estate in
in one of the most expensive cities in the world.
That's right. And so they're going to get rid of that headquarters. And I think they're going to distribute themselves around London and then set up a headquarters in a town outside of London, which they haven't specified. So, of course, they have buildings all over the country because they're the dominant carrier here. They're the leftovers of the dominant government carrier back in the days when government centralized carriers were the thing. But, getting that number of workers in and out of central London is expensive, and owning that building is expensive. And BT's had a couple of years of pretty torrid financials.
Returns.
They had a massive scandal in the Italian unit that cost $500 million to clean up. They've got problems with their pension schemes. They're not funding their pension schemes at the right level. And they've also been struggling to keep profits. The government here has also disentangled them from. So the way that the UK works is that the cable in the ground is owned by the government. And then there's a company that sits above it called Openreach, which runs the cable in the ground, so operates, and it runs on a for-profit basis. So the cable is owned by the government on behalf of the country, but it's run by a for-profit organization called Openreach. And BT has the rights to manage that business and extract profits by managing and operating it. The government's been putting more and more conditions on them, so the profits have been less and less. So yes, I think we're going to see telcos lay off a lot of stuff in the coming years as automation creeps in, white box creeps in, and we start to see the internet replace MPLS services, you know, and much more around what 5G and mobile is. We don't need all of the stuff that we used to have completely, you know, you just don't need the headcount as you move forward.
Yeah, I'm referencing a story from SDX Central here. They're saying the layoffs are going to come in back office and middle management roles. But at the same time, BT also said it had plans to hire 6,000 engineers and frontline employees as they prepare to roll out 5G and then associated services with 5G.
Yeah. So, you know, get rid of them, tell them to go, let them go and retrain themselves and then hire them back.
Probably. Well, I don't know. There's definitely a difference between middle managers and engineers.
Yeah. I think being familiar with these big old telcos, they got fat and lazy. This is what happens when you don't have the competition. You get fat and lazy and you don't. This is what happens is eventually it gets to the point where you have to, you know, slice very deep. You have to cut off big chunks to survive.
All right, our last story for the day, it's in our surfing dog file. At Google's recent developer event, the company demoed a new service it's working on called Duplex. You may have heard about it. It's an AI service. It combines a computer-generated voice to an AI to complete small tasks via the telephone, like make an appointment at a hair salon or make a restaurant reservation. The issue is the computer voice is designed to sound exactly like a human, including the use of human phrases like and ah. And they actually, on the blog, we have a link to it in the show notes. They play you a couple of demos of an actual computer that sounds like a person calling a hair salon, calling a restaurant to perform these tasks. And it is kind of creepy.
It's probably unethical, I think.
Well, that's what Google. I mean, the developers were like, this is awesome. Look at what we're doing. And a lot of techies were like, this is cool. But some other people were like, whoa, wait a second here. What are you doing?
Yeah, you're representing a computer as a
human. Yeah.
Which is a fundamental lie.
Yes, that's the issue. Is it ethical to have a computer pretend to be a human without the person on the other end knowing that they're talking to a machine?
Yes. And so that aside, I mean, I think it is incredibly deceptive to think, you know, whatever. And I think there's a great room for error here. So it's my concern is what happens when this goes wrong. So if the computer books an appointment for 4 and you turn up and somebody actually says 4 and 5, you know, whatever, an appointment actually gets... Who gets blamed, right? Is it Google? Is it the shop? Is it the person who booked the call? So there are responsibility issues here, that the gaps that just open up. People are going to go, oh, well, a hairdresser doesn't really matter. I promise you, for a hairdresser, it really does matter. You know, this idea of letting a computer do all the scheduling for you. And the other issue that I saw come up on Twitter a lot was, what happens if the restaurant's using a voice, an IVR, voice response system?
And you've got a computer talking to a computer.
Yes. What happens when you've got a computer talking to a computer? That doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah. To me, the issue is obviously computers are going to get things wrong sometimes, and then we always figure out who to blame. And usually it's not the big company. But this notion that this sort of, you know, dissolving the barrier of computers and humans in their interactions, and how it seems to me there needs to be, we haven't figured out the ethical and moral guidelines around how we relate to machines and what are the obligations of people running the machines to let humans know when they're actually interacting with a machine and not a person. And so we're getting into weird territory these days.
We are, but I do think there's a, you know, as we get into SDN and we get more into this easy, reliable, trustable, predictable control of networks, it's only a matter of time until some artificial intelligence, you know, or some pseudo intelligence comes along and starts making the changes for us.
Yep.
So this issue does flow into what you do here, because what is happening in greater society is the consumer market drives the enterprise IT market. So if you have these automated systems working in retail, then your executives are going to go, well, it works for booking a hair appointment. Why is this automation not working for my network?
Right. Let's make it work for running our help desk. Exactly. Yeah. Why is my computer slow? Oh, yeah. Let me take a look at that for you.
Why am I not using artificial intelligence to drive my infrastructure? Why am I?
Yeah.
And I know that's crazy, but that's how it works. You know, executives spend most of their time looking at getting promoted to the next level because they care about that sort of thing.
And figuring out how they can save money by firing people.
That's exactly right. So quite often, yes, indeed. Or do more with less and all that sort of hoofah. But in the old days, it was always like, well, we'll have to carefully evaluate that. But if you're using a technology to book hair appointments, you'll go, why is, and I know this is counterintuitive, but that's how it works.
Right.
As smartphones came along, and guess what? It wasn't enterprises that picked up smartphones. It was consumers and apps and, you know, online banking. And now we expect to just be able to run our networks via a cloud app.
Right. And we're also seeing consumers become very comfortable with interacting with machines to do things like ordering stuff via a little box or, you know, columnar device on your desk saying, you know, Siri, whatever, go buy me XYZ. So who knows? Maybe people want this kind of thing. And
I wouldn't want to over say a lot of consumers. I think some consumers.
So you're right. I guess we live in sort of a bubble of technically forward-leaning people. Yeah, some consumers like this.
Yeah, there are some people. The future's here. It's not evenly distributed. You know,
as William Gibson says, yes.
Yeah, that's right. I think that, yes, there are a number of people who are willing to put Amazon Dash buttons and click them. Buy me more detergent and it just turns up, or buy more toilet paper, blah, blah, blah. I'm not at all sure that that's very widely distributed, that a substantial, that the world per se is doing that yet.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm always conscious of the fact that, but the people who are doing it are the early adopters. Let's go back to the beginning of the show where Arista says it's doing campus. Well, it wants to do campus. It's planning to do campus, but it's going to take a while to get there. That's what we try and do on this show, is look at these issues and look at the how the start grows into something over time and try and make a range of predictions about where that's going to head to.
Yeah. This for me, though, hearing the interactions, I really strongly encourage you, if you haven't, go to the blog link and listen to the interactions. And there's something about it that just makes me think, okay, this stuff is real, and my brain starts going in all kinds of weird directions. So anyway, that's what our show is about.
I do have some concerns about the ethics of that. And really, it should say something like, you know, this is a Google robot booking an appointment, and people should not feel. Because what happens if they go off script? Like, the script was very carefully like, can I book an appointment for 4 o'clock on Friday? And the person said, yeah, okay. I wonder how many calls they had to make before they had a nice clean script that would stand up.
That's right. Yes, we should keep that in mind, that they did get to cherry pick the calls they shared with us.
Yes. Now, I'm not saying that Google lied. I'm just saying if it took 1,000 phone calls for that to work.
Yeah, they put their best foot forward.
Yeah. So we'll see.
All right. Well, that wraps up this news. Please stay tuned for our Coffee Talk conversation with VMware. We're going to be talking about VeloCloud SD-WAN integration with NSX, and that's coming right up. Hello and welcome to Coffee Talk from the Packet Pushers, a fast, informative, sponsored conversation that gets you up to speed on interesting ideas and technologies in about the time it takes to drink a coffee. I'm Drew Connery Murray. Greg Farrow is here. We're sponsored today by VMware, and we're talking about SD-WAN and VMware's VeloCloud acquisition and how VeloCloud is being integrated with NSX. Our guest is Sanjay Appal. He is VP and GM of the VeloCloud business unit. Sanjay, welcome to the show. And it's been about 5 months since the acquisition closed. Can you get us up to speed on life inside VMware?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, take a step back and, you know, drink your latte, because we're going to walk through some really exciting stuff here. So we've been as a part of VMware for about 5 months now. And in that 5 months, we've physically moved on campus for about a month now. And we've kept the same look and feel that we had at VeloCloud, meaning open, transparent environment, close communication with our customers and partners, because what's happening in the SD-WAN space is that, as you folks know very well, it's taking off like a rocket. And so being part of VMware, we are combining the successful product that we have at VeloCloud with the go-to-market machine that is VMware to get out to all the customers and partners out there.
So being inside VMware must be a great fit for you, because you've got this big engine, they've got this great relationship with all these enterprises and even some service providers as well, and you, that's exactly where VeloCloud wants to be at. It must be a big change to go from, you know, knock on a door, hello, I'm VeloCloud, who, to be, I'm part of VMware. It's like, come on in, sit down. Is that the sort of thing we're looking at?
Yes, pretty much. Though I'd like to think that when I locked on the door, people actually knew who we were. But yeah, but you're right. I mean, as many places, especially if you think of the financial community outside of North America, okay. If you go and say, they might know who VeloCloud was, but will they be able to trust all their financial traffic to a small startup in Mountain View? Perhaps not. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, as being part of VMware, we don't have to go through that skepticism and that hurdle. They welcome that we have come in. And for those of them who are already VMware customers, and on the enterprise side, it's difficult to find an enterprise customer that has not got some part of VMware product or technology deployed. So that relationship that VMware already has with the enterprises, you know, goes a long way towards getting VeloCloud in there and deployed. Now, as you said, even on the service provider side, I like the way you put it, but basically on the service provider side, VMware, you know, has been making a very strong foray with their NFV offering. And what VeloCloud is doing is saying, hey, look, you know, you want to deploy a service. Here's a rock solid service that's taking off, you know, because enterprises love the ROI benefits. And so why don't you just combine that as a VNF running on the NFV platform? So we've got both a go-to-market motion, so to speak, and traction with enterprises and the VMware customer base. But we've also got one on the service provider side, you know, really starting off with the 60 or so service providers we already had, and we're kind of accelerating that as a part of VMware.
I think that's important because I recently saw a demo when I last visited HQ there about the stitching, the federated stitching of carriers together so that you can share underlays and overlays, and I thought that was awesome. But that's not what we want to talk about today. What I want to talk about is you've got a new name. So VeloCloud's coming up with a new name for its product now that you're inside the VMware kimono. What's that?
So what we are calling this now is NSX SD-WAN by VeloCloud. Now, you know, you might think that that's a mouthful, but SD-WAN by VeloCloud, you know, that's the obvious one. The new thing, of course, is NSX.
Right.
And so NSX has always been associated with the data center offering that VMware has had. And this came out of the NYSERA acquisition with all the additional enhancements that they've made. They pioneered the micro-segmentation use case in the data center. So what we're saying now is, you know, think of NSX as not just being in the data center. NSX extends out to the branch offices with SD-WAN. NSX, you can get traffic to the cloud offering through NSX Cloud, and now you have an NSX SD-WAN. So NSX is now the family brand under which all of networking at VMware is pulled together, and that's why we are now calling this NSX SD-WAN by VeloCloud.
So is this just like a branding exercise, or is there anything new that's being tied into VeloCloud and NSX?
Yeah, so it's actually, it is a branding exercise, as well as there's an actual integration going on. And where the actual integration is, I think, is very powerful for both financial as well as retail customers. So as you know, what we do from a SD-WAN side is we can separate out traffic by segments. And the cool thing with VeloCloud is that you can have these segment IDs, even with overlapping IP addresses, and we have an automated way to, through a business policy, to say, what should be inside the segment and what do you keep separated? But we can separate out both performance and security all the way from thousands of branch offices through the wide data network back to the, you know, the, either the private or the public data center. The integration point...
Just to clarify that, what you're actually saying there is you're stitching micro-segmentation in the WAN, in that branch network, the branch WAN that you used to have. We now are with SD-WAN, we can create micro-segments right the way out to where the edge SD-WAN device is, and you're going to stitch those overlays into the same micro-segmentation that's happening in the data center. So effectively, end-to-end micro-segmentation that's, and it's unified in the controllers, or it.
Correct, yes. Correct. Yeah, so actually to be totally accurate, there's a mapping of segments out to the NSX routing domain. So indeed, what you can do is take an application or a set of users or, you know, an SSID as an example in a branch, and then bring it all the way back into the data center and be associated with a specific routing domain that NSX can map into. Right. And then, so that is a segment-to-segment mapping. Then what you can do over and above that is you can get a microsegment, meaning that in the specific virtual machine that's running the branch, you can have it talk to a specific virtual machine or collection of virtual machines that are running back in the data center. So as you were saying, yes, it's an extension of microsegmentation from the data center all the way out into the branch. Mm-hmm. And it's also a mapping of the segment IDs from the WAN perspective into the NSX routing domains.
So this means the tellers in the branch, literally almost down to the teller. So I've got a teller in a branch, in a banking branch, I can say that that teller belongs to this microsegment, which travels over the WAN, which travels into this part of the data center, and they only see the VMs in the data center. Now, these are VMs in the data center, and they could only see, so maybe the only thing the teller sees is the RDP, the thin client VMs. They see nothing else. No laser printers, no gateways, no internet, you know, whatever it is, the only thing they see in the data center or in the WAN is just what you're going to let them see.
Correct. That's right. And, you know, of course, one can stitch this together manually, right? You can say that, okay, let's set up a VLAN construct. Let's map it into a segment ID. Let's repack it out in terms of the IP addresses it's coming from. And if they're overlapped, then we have to separate it out. Let's put it into the separate routing domains. And that's a big headache. That requires a lot of, you know, CCIEs running around and doing CLI commands. What we've done is we've automated it so that very simply, you can set up these segments, you can tear them down, you can do it on the basis of business policy. So you can get not just security separation, but from a SD-WAN perspective, you can also get a performance difference starting with the VeloCloud Edge and getting to, you know, either another VeloCloud Edge or to the VeloCloud Gateway.
Because the VeloCloud Edge or Edge and Gateway recognizes applications, not IP addresses. And what we're also seeing is features coming into the latest generations of NSX where they also recognize applications. So in a sense,
that's
you could actually build a microsegment which is app to app. So I want to recognize this thin client app at the branch and I want it to recognize thin clients wherever they are in the data center and boom. I didn't even have to define where, how, what. It's all done intelligently in the network using the SDN controller type metaphor at the top.
Yes, yes. It's using the separation data control plane metaphor and also using the metaphor that IP addresses you may use in the underlay, but what you want to use in the overlay is really users and applications. So you can, you know, in the longer terms, we showed a demo of this at the Mobile World Congress where you talked about getting it back to an application, but you can also get it back to an individual user. We showed a demo of this that SD-WAN tying with NSX in the data center, but then tying in with end user computing. VMware's other offering, which is runs on clients, and now you can identify the client. And so you can think of the same physical network as being built either for a specific application, it's being built for a specific group of users, it's being built for an individual user. I mean, it's the same physical network. And that's really the power of virtualization coming out of the data center all the way into the edges of the enterprise.
Hmm. So you're saying if I'm at the branch and I've got two connections coming out, like an internet connection and maybe an MPLS connection, I can make policies, you know, sort of a set of policies for internet and a set of policies for MPLS. But with this micro-segmentation, I can also have sort of policies within policies, super fine grained to say, right down to the application, right down to the user, I want these kind of performance metrics, these sort of security controls?
Yeah, correct. And, you know, ordinarily, what you wouldn't quite say that I want a policy for MPLS and I want a policy for the internet. What you would say is, I want a policy for the business's applications and the outcomes that I want. And the typical outcome is, hey, look, I want my enterprise applications to run well. I want my POS to run well. I want my inventory to run well. But if somebody's running Netflix out of the branch office in the retail store, they don't really care about that. And so why choke up my bandwidth? Or if there's some internet breakout that's happening at the branch office location, then I better scrub the traffic. So I better send it to either an on-premise security or send it back to my data center or send it to a cloud security. So the kinds of policies that you set will be application layer, will be security aware, and then could be about groups of users or individual users. And what RSD-WAN does is then it steers that traffic on a per packet basis on the internet link or on the MPLS link or on the LTE link, and in the future, even on LPWAN links to make sure that that business policy is not violated.
I think that internet breakout's important. So, for example, in the branch, you could have a situation where, as we talked about a minute ago, the tellers are in their own microsegment and restricted heavily. But you could have a guest Wi-Fi, which goes directly to the internet, and maybe you decide you want to make sure that that's safe, so you pass it through an online service like a Zscaler for scanning and malware protection and to make sure that the content is socially acceptable so that nothing happens to you. And that can all be done in just this one product.
Absolutely. So, you can think of it as this giant selection switch at every branch office location that operates on the basis of a business policy. And that selection switch is dynamic. You can say, okay, for this instance, this traffic that is coming on guest Wi-Fi, let me get it scrubbed with my Zscaler and send it on. But you might think that, hey, there's a specific application within that guest traffic and where that application is actually accessing your corporate a banking app. And in that specific case, you do not want to just dump it out on the internet. You want to give it some specialized access. All of those decisions can be made on the fly on the basis of the business policy. They can be dynamic. The services insertion can be dynamic. With security, can be at the edge, can be in the hub, can be in the data center, can be in the cloud. And in fact, we're working with all of the security vendors, as you know very well, because last year we announced this ecosystem. And so we're stitching all this together from a best of breed approach.
So the SD-WAN space is pretty hot, as you mentioned that at the top, Sanjay. What is the competitive landscape like out there for NSX SD-WAN?
Yeah, so what's it boiling down to is that, we're no longer, of course, at the early adopter phase. We've got, thousands of customers deployed. I think overall, from an industry standpoint, we're probably approaching, in the high thousands of customers. And we've crossed several thousand of our own. And so we're beyond that early adopter phase. But the very cool thing about this is that, the growth is not slowing down. The growth is, just came back from a trip to India, New Zealand, and Australia, and just saw that, even at locations that one that, we VeloCloud had not ordinarily gone after because we just simply did not have the reach. Well, enterprises and service providers out there are really hungry to get their SD-WANs deployed. And so that's the exciting part. Now, people always ask me, well, wait a minute, there's, 40 vendors in this space. If you actually parse it out, there aren't. Everybody has to say that they have some SD-WAN because of what the enterprises want to do is they looking for SD-WAN. It actually shows up in RFPs as a requirement when you come up with the next generation of network architecture. But there are, I'd say a handful of competitors, five or so that are the serious ones that we will come up against. I do expect that there'll be some more consolidation in this space as we move along one way or another. But, the competitors are robust. We believe very much in our architecture, which is all cloud delivered. But there's several good solutions.
You wouldn't be here if you didn't. I guess that's a good question. How would you say NSX SD-WAN? I mean, we talked about some of the ways that NSX SD-WAN differentiates. But is there any others that's like as we get close to wrapping this up, is there any particular features that differentiate you from other SD-WAN companies then?
Yeah, so there's three things that are very different. One is that we run a service. We run SD-WAN as a service. We don't sell it direct. We go through a service provider or an IT company. And that service is run on 500 gateways at 30 points of presence, supports billions of transactions. So this is a running service. Mm-hmm. And this service, we don't sell the transport. It runs purely as an overlay. And this service, the data goes through the service as well. This is not just people say cloud first. Cloud first doesn't mean just cloud managed. Cloud first means you're actually using the cloud as the network, which is what we've been saying all along. So that's the first highly distinguished feature. The second one is that we can support real-time traffic on best effort networks. We can make your voice calls, video, VDI, and IoT work, even if it's a non-private nail-down connection. So that's the second one. And the third one is, it's the level of simplicity and automation. I used to always say that, VeloCloud systems have been designed for Lisa because Lisa used to be my office manager. She was non-technical and people would say designed in California, built in China. I would say designed for Lisa. So, you got to see that to believe that because it really is, highly simple. You can set up an entire branch office network for an enterprise, in less than a day.
I've seen these interfaces. I've done demos with these interfaces. They are extraordinary how easy it is to do. Things that used to be incredibly hard are now actually really quite straightforward. The GUI takes away what I would call tedious, dull work and replaces it, leaving you time to do interesting, useful work.
You got that right, Greg.
So if people want to find out more, where should they go, Sanjay?
Oh, they can go to the VeloCloud site, they can go to VMware, they can go to their favorite reseller, service provider, or they can call me.
Are you social? Do you want to give a social shout out or anything, a Twitter or LinkedIn profile that you've got?
Yeah, you can go to my LinkedIn profile. You can also go to my Twitter, it's inetnut, but LinkedIn works better.
All right, very good. Well, that wraps up this episode of the Packet Pushers Coffee Talk. Thank you to our sponsor, VMware. You can find more fine, free technical podcasts at packetpushers.net. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.